To be excited about what lies ahead this weekend here at a Gulfstream in New York, too. We got the Gotham and a lot happening. Back after this, Sirius XM at the races.
At the races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown Triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, but we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Vick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Vick.
We're back at Santa Anita. A quietish morning, as we explained in the first hour, because of the heavy weather, and whenever you get the track sealed and give an extra day to get the cushion reacclimated, fluffed up, and safer. This is actually, it's, anybody that's listened to the show for any period of time, you know that Dick Powell famously has got, he's got the receipts, as the kids say. He's got the receipts on this topic, that easing a racetrack back into action after being sealed is in the best interest of everybody's health, maintenance, and welfare, etc. Rich Migliori is going to join us, and I don't know if his case is Rich there. That's a no. All right, we'll give a second for Rich to join us.
And you know, One thing I forgot, and I wanted to try and do this week while we're here, is to ask people what their favorite Sandy the Handicap was.
Oh, always good.
As a kid or whatever, and I forgot to ask Michael, and I was, as I was thinking that last night, I was trying to think of mine, and I could narrow it down to five or six. It just, so many, I mean, I'm going back to the 70s, and Royal Glint, an ancient title, was probably my number one if I had to pick one. I was a big ancient title fan, but when Royal Glint came out here for a couple times, I just latched onto that horse, and Royal Glint ended up beating ancient title by a nose. And then we had went through just such a run of Vigors, you know, the White Tornado. Daryl McCarg was on that horse, and he happened to win six that day, and that was his sixth win. And I mean, that's a YouTube special to watch that one. I mean, just see this horse just circle the field, and then we, you know, affirmed in 79, a spectacular bid when he just had one of the best four-year-old years that any racehorse could possibly have had, was here, and John Henry won it twice in a row after that. I mean, it was just star after star after star. But one of the ones that I always have to go back, and I actually did last night on the YouTube thing, and I only stayed on for about 20 minutes. Sometimes you get sucked in. Was the Broad Brush Ferdinand matchup. Sochi was in there, too, as well, in 1987. So if you're looking for, actually, if you're looking for any of them, dude, go back and check out some of those early on big caps. But that 1987 Broad Brush Ferdinand with Angel Cordero on Broad Brush and the shoe, of course, on Ferdinand, and they come down to the wire, and I don't know, just so many memories. I mean, as I look, I wasn't here, I was there.
In Banfield Field.
Yeah, we held camp out there, and just a lot of memories looking out there for these. But everyone who's been to numerous big caps has a favorite, and I know those are some of mine. I was reading a little article about Kent DeSormo going for his third Breeders' Cup, but also a third win in a decade type of thing, and there's only been two. And he won with Best Pal, and then he won in with Milwaukee Brew, who was, of course, trained by Bobby Frankel. And that triggers a lengthy conversation that we had in the office with Bobby, and overweights, and I think I'm sure it was Medaglia d'Or he had, and here he was whining about the weights, whining, and you know how he can do. I mean, he should have been this, should have been that, and lo and behold, he was never even going to run that. He enters Milwaukee Brew instead after, you know, boom, and go ahead and just and wins it.
And wins anyway.
Wins anyway. It's just like, you know, that guy was so good, but he was arguing, you know, about 1 pound. And you know, just classically, but I will tell you, and I've said this before, in those lengthy conversations that somehow got heated, but just heated between us, nothing personal, it was just back and forth. When he left the room, I wrote down half a dozen things that he had suggested
there
and said, and it's
there
like, oh,
you
go. He didn't really want to let him know that he was right, but you learn the next time, because he'd point out about a race, and you shouldn't do this, and you should look at this instead of that, and, you know, I'd be shaking my head like, okay, and then write it down when he walked out the room. But sharp, just super sharp.
Rich Migliori is joining us, and I'm sure, Mig, as fun as it is to be home, you wouldn't mind being out here, the Clocker's Corner, looking up at the snow-capped peaks. Good morning.
No, it must be spectacularly beautiful, and I would get Rick to hike up to Mount Wilson with me. It'd be hammer time.
I'm on it. In fact, yesterday I sent a shot from my street up to the. I was pulling out early in the morning to get over here, and there was snow up there, and I'm getting on the freeway, and I go, I should turn around and go back because it's right near where I hike. And I actually called my wife. I go, you got to go up to Rocky Peak. I was so close to turning around and blowing off what I had to do here to go back and go on that hike, which I will do today. But yes, if you were out here, we'd be hiking up to the hill.
Yeah, look, it looks spectacular, really beautiful. And I'm actually at Belmont. I didn't go home last night, Steve. He was a head outrider for, or pony person for Pancho Martin for years, and then he was valet in the jockey's room for a number of years, Rudy Garcia. He passed away, and I have his wake this afternoon, so I said I'm going to stay down, pay my respects. He actually saved my life when I was 14 years old. I was on a horse for Steve Gamoro on the pony track, and the bridle literally came apart, and I was on a horse with no bridle, running full tilt around that little pony track, and hanging on to the mane, and he came barreling out of Pancho's barn, which was adjacent to the pony track, and somehow caught the horse by his ear, by his nose, and pulled me up without a bridle on him. And we became very good friends ever since. And, the, you know, like we talk about yogiisms, there were a lot of Rudyisms over the years. He had to go upstairs to cash a check for a rider and pick up a racing form. So he told the rider, I'm going to wait till the check cashing's open so I can go up there and get the form, cash the check, and kill one bird with two stones. So he was quite a race
back there. I appreciate you passing it along, and I also should mention John McKee passed at
West Virginia. John McKee,
yeah.
A super nice big man that great developer, 2-year-old. Oh, sorry. It's hard to see. Sorry to see that. He was a guy that we would call from Monmouth Park and
try to
get John McKee on the phone. Larry Howley, old Larry. I'll get John. Boom. He'd drive him over, put him in, and they'd win for fun.
Unbelievable. Yeah, we've got to get. I've reached out to a couple of people to pay respects. One of the real titans out there, who probably somebody that probably there's been any number of horsemen that made the transfer from Charlestown to the Maryland circuit, which was, if you're up and coming, that's your goal. And then there's some that just stayed there and we probably could have gone. We talk about this with Tony Rich. Tony could have ridden on any circuit in the country, but he was quite happy to be in Jersey and Philly. The same kind of thing with a guy like John McKee.
Yeah, I mean it's a balance, right? You want to balance your personal life with your professional life, and what is true success when you find that harmony, that balance, where you're content professionally and obviously content and taking care of everybody you love personally. So it's a hard high wire act, if you will. But guys that can do it and are happy, that's true success.
Well put. Well, and that actually is a perfect kind of a segue to the conversation we had just earlier with Michael W. McCarthy. Then when I mentioned you were coming and we were talking about the Hill, and you came out here, you won yourself a Breeders' Cup race that was important, obviously, to you. I mean, you certainly would have won. You would have won the Breeders' Cup Mile on Artie Schiller had you not gotten hurt. So getting Desert Code and getting that win down the hill. But Hammer was talking about how you came out here and immediately took to the hill.
Well, what was interesting about that is the first week I got out there, and you're not riding much because people are just getting to know you and you're working horses. We were still at Hollywood Park. I had dinner with Lafitte. Pink Eye, the jockey, not the broadcaster. I got to differentiate that now. And he was talking to me about the hill. He was talking to me about Bill Spahr, and I made it a mission to get in Bill's barn, and that was a great bonus to me. But he said, don't feel bad if you don't win the race down the hill right away. It's tricky. It took me a while to get the hang of it. And what I started doing was when if I rode one or two at Hollywood Park and I lived right behind Santa Anita, I would get back over there and I'd park on Colorado and I'd hop the fence and I'd walk the course and walk from the top of the hill down and just think about it a lot. And the right hand bend first and then how you fold back to the left, and started watching a lot of replays. And I rode 4 or 5 down the hill, and I got to be honest with you, I felt like a cork on a river. I just, woo, going this way, now we're going that way. And I rode a horse for Ron McAnally named Tycoon, which I think is New Zealand bred. And he basically, looked back at me and said, just sit tight and I'll show you how to do this. And this horse was such a Cadillac down the hill. He jumped his right lead, hugged the right bend, came back, and he won easy. And it was like a light bulb went on. This horse just showed me how to ride this, you know, course. And I wound up winning 15 down the hill that winter, more than anybody else. I think David Flores won 11 or 12, but I actually won 15 down the hill. And then, of course, the next year winning the Breeders' Cup on, yeah. So it was pretty cool. But that horse really, he kind of opened my eyes to, like, oh, this is, and a lot of guys never paid a lot of attention to the right-handed bend. And actually, I did. And I felt like you picked up a length or two there if you were conscious about that.
Well, you know, I remember that, man, because I told Steve that you were one of the very few that just all of a sudden you got it. And Michael McCarthy was explaining that there is a right-hand turn. And I remember Eddie D talking to me about positioning yourself, you know, for the next, you know, eighth of a mile and another eighth of a mile, where you need to be and where you need not to be. So you're in position that you have momentum when you're making that turn down the hill. And, you know, you just did it. You had it. But see, I didn't know the sneaky part that you did your homework by walking the hill. And I think I was telling Steve earlier, I should get a go-kart and kind of come down the hill and do a little video of all the nuances that there is coming down the hill. You hit that magic carpet right off the bat.
Well, yeah, thank you. And again, I, you know, when you ride horses that handle it well, you know, horses waste more energy when they're checking themselves. So you get like a heavier, you know, hard hitting kind of horse. That first 100 yards, and if you do that, go up to the top of the hill with the golf cart. Pay attention. You're eye level with the top of the grandstand. That's how high you're starting. And you get a horse that loses his confidence, that first 100 yards is the most severe drop, and they start checking themselves, and they lose more energy checking themselves because they feel like they're out of balance, they're out of sync. But you get one that could run down that hill, and even if they go faster, they're using less energy. And you know, like a Desert Code, I mean, that horse was made for the hill, and what an incredible job Dave Hoffman did with him, because he wasn't always the best moving horse. But even that, like we talk about listening to your horses, he was a horse that usually laid up close, and it was a 14-horse field, Breeders' Cup, so I came out looking for position, and he pinned his ears at me and kind of like slowed down, and I said, man, this horse is telling me something. I got to trust him. So I put my hands down, and he backed up to second to last. They went 41-4. He was telling me, knucklehead, they're going too quick. Leave me alone. And, you know, so he really, again, you know, when you get in tune with your horses in a course like that, you have to. You know, you feel it. I honestly, most fun riding that hill. It was such a thrill. And the things you learned, like don't move into the dirt because horses are going to jump leads and duck and scatter like quail. So when you think you got to, you know, move, be a little more patient and let them kind of explode and then find your spot. And you could win on the fifth best horse down the hill. I mean, you really could make a difference. And that's fun for a rider. You know, I rode a lot of races that I didn't ride well and the horse won because they were best. And I rode races that were great and finished fourth and got criticized. But that was one where you felt like you could really make a difference.
I got a half a dozen things listening to that that I should mention. Number one, Rick, is there should be some sort of a trophy, like a little, you know, a little trifle for the jockey who wins the most races down the hill during the course of a season, right?
Well, for me, it would have been the over-the-hill trophy.
Hey, ho! Hey now,
that's not a bad idea.
That's right. Shouldn't there be?
Absolutely.
I like that. Then, Rich,
part grass, part dirt.
Very cool. And when you talk about a horse and their balance, I bring this up every time there's an opportunity. Horses have one great fear in their existence, and that's falling down and being on the ground where a cougar or a mountain lion can pounce on them before they can get back to their feet. So when horses are tentative in terms of footing, that's why. And that's why surfaces do matter. And I just bristle when I hear somebody say, oh, you know, every wet track is a wet track, and Churchill's main track is no different than this one. Composition means a lot. Horses slide on the dirt and their hooves stick on the grass or synthetic, and the way they're conformed and their confidence in their footing means everything to them. That's why we'll go back to last our trip to Kentucky Downs and Steve Asmussen talking about his big galunky scared horse that coming down the hill absolutely was scared to death about falling, and then when he hit the bottom, when he hit the straight and the flat, took off. And this is, you know, they're living, breathing, you know, all right, they got a brain the size of a lemon, but they're thinking beings, and this is how, you know, they, as Rich, as you just explained, they're communicating, you know, they understand the surroundings and the circumstances.
No, absolutely, and you know, listen, self-preservation in any species is paramount, right? And you, while you were saying that about horses laying down, I got to share this story, and I hope nobody thinks less of me. We were kids, but a friend of mine, when I went out to live at my grandfather's house on Long Island, his dad had a pony ride business, and he would buy wild ponies. This guy would have them shipped in from the west out in Riverhead, and I'm not saying unbroken. I mean, they were feral. They were, like, rounded up, like, off planes, and then would come in on these trucks, and we would have to break them. And we had a filly that we just couldn't break. If she couldn't buck you off, her go-to move was she would just throw herself on the ground. So then you had to come off, right?
Roll over on you.
Yeah, but, like, she'd be in a full bronc buck and then just flop sideways like a fish, right? And we read this book. We were, you know, kids. I think I was like 11 or 12 years old. And we're reading this book, and this old cowboy, how if a horse like flips over or does that, you don't let them get up. Kind of like that scene in A Bronx Tale. Now you can't leave, right? Like,
yeah.
So we set up. We had like ropes, and I was on her. And David Figueroa, a tremendous horseman. Now he's actually training horses again in Aiken, and she did her move, couldn't get me off, flopped, and I was on her head, and we hobbled her, and we were able to tie up one leg to her hind leg, and she could get up. And then the way the book said is, like, you stack them out with a you know, a garbage bag or a rain slicker, and we kept her on the ground for a good half hour, 35 minutes, and really scared this poor pony, right? Steve, she never did it again, but I don't think she ever laid down in her life again. She got broke, but I mean, she slept standing up.
It's interesting. No, that's interesting. That there's a balance, I guess, right? That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, listen, looking back on it, I feel almost bad about it, but like, we got it done. We just didn't know a better method at that time.
No, you're making me think of the conversation. I had a conversation at a Breeders' Cup. I found myself sitting, it might have been like a big cap day, with Bruce Hedley over by the gift shop. And Hedley told me about, you know, some of the education he got. He learned from a cowboy that came to California in a Conestoga wagon. He said,
wow.
A guy, I mean, as old as Bruce was, Bruce said that when he was a kid, the guy was in his 80s. So this has got to be in what, the 30s or 40s? So you're talking about somebody that was probably born in 1840. And there were so many crazy, unusual, you know, people thought Bruce, you know, Bruce wouldn't take a horse to the paddock. He didn't believe, he thought that made horses nervous.
Interesting.
It made them edgy coming to the paddock for race day.
You know, what his daughter Karen did with those videos before he passed away that she was posting on Twitter was just phenomenal. And, you know, and talking about the Susie Q Ranch and Shoemaker and, it, you know, coming up as a kid on the racetrack and so many things even though I was like a generation after, that I could relate to, and they were wonderful. What a great history that she was able to record there. And, you know, go back like Mitchell Griffin when he trained for Hooper, and then he actually assisted Woody Stevens with the Swear and 49er when Woody was sick. He was incredible with two-year-olds, and his belief was you don't work horses out of the gate far, because then they'll always correlate going to the gate with stress, that they're, you know, their lungs are going to burn, they're going to have to dig down. He would get his two-year-olds okayed out of the gate before they were half-mile fit. And all they would do is jump out of the gate and go 50 yards, and then you'd ease them up. And he also contended that they absorbed their lessons faster before they were dead fit, 100% fit. So he would get all those lessons done earlier when they were more amenable to learning them. And his babies were always good in the gate, and they always left there flying. They left there running. And quickly getting back to that pony we broke, my friend's father was really good about it. Like, there was always ponies that were bomb-proof that we would sell at a big profit to, you know, families. A lot of kids had ponies on Long Island. And there were always some that were bomb-proof, but they were ugly. And so they would go in the pony ride for parties business, you know, birthday parties would show up with these ponies. And then the ones that were always a little hot, he would never sell or use for the pony rides because he wouldn't take a chance to ruin his reputation getting a kid hurt on one of his ponies. So that pony we never could, you know, sell for a little kid to ride. But they had pony races through 4-H back then. She had won 5 in a row. And I still contend she's the fastest thing I ever sat on for 150 yards. And there was a match race between a horse and her, and I won the match race after she, like, belly down. It had rained the night before. She got up, caught the other horse, won the race. It was like a $100 match race. We went back to the barn, and we watched Forgo catch Honest Pleasure in the Marlboro Cup. And that was when I told everybody, because in my mind's eye, I just did what Shoemaker did on Forgo on this little pony. And I told everybody that day, I'm going to be a jockey. That sealed it. So that pony had a big part in my history.
That's great. And I mean, that I remember that we brought that race up as Ricker. Wide World of Sports. They would show a race every Sunday, and, you know, being out here in California, we were glued to that, and we got to watch that. And fantastic stuff. You mentioned Bruce Headley. One thing about Bruce Headley, there's no such thing as a short story when it comes to Bruce. He is great at telling stuff, and boy, he mentioned the cowboy way, and he did things slow, methodical, got him ready. And as a racing secretary, that wasn't always the greatest thing that we appreciated. It's like he'd tell you the story, and, you know, before the meet started in December, about these, you know, three-year-olds he's got, 2-year-olds turning three. Oh my gosh. It'd be about February. Hey, Bruce, what about those horses? Yeah, they're almost ready. And then, you know, hopefully by May they got a start. And, you know, when they got there, it was fine. But he took his time about things the old-fashioned way. And you know, when horses hit the track, they were ready. They were fit. They were to go. And, you know, you just look back at some of the horses he had. And, of course, you zero in on Kona Gold, at least I do. And it almost kind of was a nutshell of his whole career with how he those horses that hit the ground. I mean, what did he run in, 3, 4, 5 Breeders' Cups? Finally got the dough. Did Kona Gold make the Hall of Fame yet? I know he's on the thing. I don't think he has, and I don't know how. If he's not, I don't know how he's not in there. But that Kona Gold is a personification of Bruce. You mentioned him. A couple other names you mentioned, Ron McAnally. He's here this morning. He's one of the first person I saw walking in the gate. Yeah, he comes and he's still a Clocker's Corner regular and sits out here and, you know, enjoys watching the, you know, talking to his buddies and the horses go by, and it's great to see Ron. And you mentioned Bill Spahr. Bill ran his last horse last weekend, kind of quietly. Just said he's you know, hanging him up. And
you know what? I didn't realize that. I got to give him a call. You know, there were guys that supported me there, and, you know, obviously great professional relationships, but that I became, you know, friends with. And you know, Bill, I mean, talk about, he had the key to the quarter pole. He was in the barn before his grooms were in there. By 4 o'clock in the morning, he was in the barn And I would get there very early because I just enjoyed our conversations. And I mean, he really was a key component to me getting off the mark in California. I mean, he showed a lot of trust in me. He put me on a horse. This is kind of funny. Lafitte also told me with Bill, just be consistent when you show up at the barn and don't ask him to work horses. Don't ask him to ride. And you know, but he'll kind of start counting on seeing you at the same time. So I'm out in California. My wife and kids are in New York. I stayed on New York time. So I would get up by 4:30 in the morning so I could talk to the kids before they went to school, and I was getting to the track at 5. And I'd see Bill at 5 every morning, and this went on for about 2 weeks. And then he says to me, hey, you want to get on one on the training track? And the other thing that Lafitte told me is, you know, some of his horses won't feel good, but he's a great horseman. So he goes, if he asks you, what do you think's wrong with him? Don't say it anything. He knows. He's just testing you. So I go out in the dark. Well, then I asked Lafitte too. I said, yeah, but won't you sound dumb? And he goes, I used to say, I think his feet bother him a little. And he, you know, leave it at that, right? So I go work this horse on the training track in the pitch dark. I'm listening to the peacocks in the neighborhood over there. I didn't even know what that was. A kid from Brooklyn, I hear these cries. I'm like, oh, my God, what is this? And I work this horse. He feels terrible. So we're walking up through the tunnel, and Bill goes, how'd that go? I said, okay. You know, he goes, how do you feel? I said, you know, Bill, I think his feet bother him a little. He started laughing. He had to know Lafitte told me what to say. So I rode a horse for him like a week later, 20 to 1, finished third. Rode another one from a big price, finished third or fourth. And I was done like the fifth race at Hollywood Park. And he grabbed me by the jockey's room and he said, listen, Nakatani's on my horse, Corey's on my horse in the last. If he takes off, will you ride my horse? He says, will you stick around? I said, of course I will. I'm just going to go back to an empty apartment in Sierra Madre, right? So I look at the program. The horse is 3 to 1. I said, well, he's not going to take off this horse. So I took a shower. I got dressed. I didn't leave. I was there. And Corey got beat on the favorite of Neil Drysdale's in the 7th, which was the feature. And he came in and he said, take me off the last. So Bill comes running in the room and he sees me dressed. He says, what? You're not going to ride my horse? No, I'll ride it. And she won. And I wound up riding everything for him. I was his first co-rider. Great guy and great horse.
Fantastic guy. Got to know him in the time I was here. He's a reason you would never know, but he's a big reader, and so am I. So we had our own little book club, and we would pass books back and forth. But if I was ever a little bit late coming, and late would be, you know, if I got here at 7, guess who's driving out the gate? Is Bill.
He was done.
Out the door. The door I went. And I just like, you gotta be kidding me. And if, you know what, the racetrack, you're never the first one here. It's one of the craziest things. Oh, I'm gonna go real early this morning and, you know, the parking lot's half full. But Bill, the track used to open, and I don't know what time it opens now, at 4:45. That's when the track's open. You know, the outriders get here, they do the loop, make sure everything's, you know, and there's not some stuff on the track or whatever, and then they go over and they unlock the gate and 4:45. At 4:47, if the thing wasn't open, guess what? The phone would be ringing. Hey, what's going on here? The track. And you know, my first couple of years, I'm going, who is this guy? Who cares? You know, a couple of minutes late, but boy, I'll tell you what, tell those outriders, you get there, you get that darn thing open. I don't want to be, you know, woken up again. But he loved to get his stuff done and, you know, in and out. Great guy. I don't know how many races he's won. I haven't really researched that, and I don't know what they're going to do here for him. But yeah, I ran into him the other day with him and Dale Radar, who's been his works with him for a long time. And we're coming up the steps, and he said, you know, I just saddled my last horse. I said, whoa, I didn't know that. And
I got to reach out to him.
Reach out to him. So Daryl and I went up and had a beer for Bill, and I know we're going to get together here soon and, you know, have lunch or something. But great guy. Always fun.
Great horse.
What a story. It, you know, didn't give anything up, just like you said. He kind of kept everything up there, but he got the feel, and he knew everything that was going on. So really appreciate Bill, and I'm glad you brought his name up because, like I said, just hit me. So, and him, like you mentioned, Lafitte, when Lafitte had a comeback, when the comeback was Bill, who, you know, basically put him on everything and you know, got him going again. But they were real close, for sure.
Yeah, no, great horseman and a great guy. And so, you know, you can have so much confidence riding for a guy like that, and especially, you know, a lower-level horse, a cheaper horse that, you know, they've got ailments. Man, I rode horses for him. I'd have rode a horse through a brick wall for him. I had so much confidence in him. And I was, you know, that he'd want to have dinner, you know, and like, say, well, all right, so we'll go have dinner at 5 o'clock. I ride the last. Like, we'll do it another time. Like, I can't eat 5 o'clock. Like, you know, but he probably went to bed by 8 o'clock because he was in the barn at, you know, 3:45. But I left the track at Del Mar one day after working horses, and I was driving by this park, like, not far from Del Mar, and I look over, and who's in a pickup basketball game but Bill Spahr? And the guy could play. I mean, he was an athlete. He could really play. I was blown away. You wouldn't expect that.
Now, that's the first I've heard of that.
How about that?
I'll have to bring that up, too, to him. That's great.
Well, John White is going to join us, and John was always part of the pickup games. They were serious games, right?
I didn't play here. I was in the Monmouth Leagues, but I didn't play here. You brought up something earlier, Rich, which would be a great segment one of these days, is, you know, as a rider, you know, how you feel in different barns when you ride horses. You mentioned you had confidence when you got on the back of a Bill Spahr horse. You know, it'd be nice to hear a little bit more on that, like what that means, like confidence you have, and, you know, so maybe some horse you're getting on that you're not quite sure of, and that kind of stuff, and you know, what type of horseman that you did. You would love to. We just jump on any horse, and maybe some guys you were a little leery of, and tell your agent, you know, we don't want to ride for that barn. But you know, a lot of guys out here that instill a lot of confidence when I, you know, top trainers and back there as well. But that was an interesting comment that you meant about that, and I can.
A lot of good horsemen there. You know, Jack Carava was another guy. I rode. What was the horse named? Lord Albion. God, this horse hit the ground like he was a draft horse. And I won like 4 races on him for him. Like, a lot of guys I might not have rode him for. I mean, you know, just really good horse. Janine Sahadi, tremendous horsewoman. Had the great privilege and honor of winning a grade one for Richard Mandela. And, you know, something came to my mind when you were talking about Bruce Headley. You know, and I've never said this publicly, but I always looked at Bruce like the West Coast version of Alan Jerkins. They were just east and west, so a little bit of different approaches, but they both spoke horse. And I always thought that. I would, you know, I didn't ride it really for Bruce, but I would go by the barn and watch and see things. And I said, man, this guy is just like Alan Jerkins.
Never really put that together, but I can see the connection.
Yeah, you know, the same way. Right, I mean, Alan's father was a Prussian cavalryman. Right, that was his training. It was about as old school as it gets.
They would have horses out at Hexer State Park that his father ran a livery riding stable out there, and they would get horses off the track, you know, with bow tendons and things, and, you know, mess around with them, and that's how Alan wound up coming to the track. Bring some horse that had, you know, broken down, and they got fixed up, and they'd bring them in here, and they'd win. And he told me stories about how, in the winter, his father would turn the horses out in the park. They would use the whole park like it was their own because people weren't using the park, and there was snow, and how much he believed, you know, the snow helped their legs. And then when it started getting warmer, they'd have to go round up all the horses that were, you know, out in the park.
I love it. I love it. Richie, let me, a couple minutes here. We've got about 10 to the top of the hour. Let me get some weekend recapping in from you as well. And I was at Oaklawn, and one of the things that was amazing was that, you know, given as loose as the track was in terms of the sloppiness, horses could come from anywhere, and they really did, including Wet Paint from, you know, downtown. She Broken Field ran to the wire, and then, of course, Red Route 1 didn't win, but he had basically been distanced early. Talk about how you guys watched it. I saw Paul there and LaDuca, and Maggie was on hand as well. You had a strong contingent at Oaklawn on the weekend.
Yeah, we pretty much had all hands on deck. Saturday, Acacia came in from Florida to New York. I worked both shifts. I reported and then the desk, and I mean everybody was pretty much involved. And wet paint is an unusual filly. She has a turn of foot on dirt. At least so far, what we've seen in off going, we haven't seen her on a fast track like a turf horse. And what a sensational ride she got from Flavian. I mean, it's just like you said, a broken field runner and just made every right move. But you have to have a horse that can accelerate, not just to the spot, but through the spot so you don't get shut off. And she looked like driving a sports car, in rush hour traffic, just making gaps. Very, very good. I thought the confidence game was good. You know, he was the horse that laid up closest to the pace and was able to win. Everybody else that was up on top of that pace, you know, they faded. Sneaky's horse ran second, and he came kicking home too. But the horse that I think you really got to take a long, hard look at is Reincarnate. He was not handling the going at all early, whether it was just the surface itself or the kickback, because he hadn't experienced much of that before.
Yep.
And he actually found his best stride and was rallying into traffic. He got stymied completely. And if he finished fifth or sixth at that point, you would say, wow, you know, he had excuses and you got to watch him back. But the fact that he was able to find his footing again and finish third, I think it kind of pointed him out. And he showed that he doesn't need everything to go his own way. Like he had adversity. And when you talk about these derby preps, not only are you getting them ready from a physical fitness standpoint, but you're steeling them up for what they're going to have to face in a race like the derby with the 20-horse field. You need a horse that is battle-tested and a horse that is brave. And I think Reincarnate checked those boxes. I thought the first three finishes in the Rebel were all very good, though.
Funny that you phrased it that way and framed it. I said the exact same thing earlier, and I stood. In fact, I meant to send you a picture, a very funny picture I took of Johnny that he was kind of showing. He was showing Jack Wolf and Tim Yakteen something about the way in which Reincarnate had the bit. Was holding onto the bit, and he did it with his finger in his mouth, and I didn't think Johnny wanted to be putting that picture up, but he was so excited about every part of what transpired, and some people will, you know, of course, immediately, you know, they'll take to social media and scoff at the performance and have no clue all of the things that went on and all of the positives that the horse has moving forward out of that effort. Johnny was beside himself, excited, telling Jack and Yakteen about, you know, prospects for next time. So you're 100% right. There's Yakteen right there, with John White, actually. And then there's Red Route One, who... yes, we expect him to come from off the pace, but boy, he just lost the touch with the field. But you could see on the turn, he was making up ground. And what was interesting about the decision that Torres made, he made the same move that Pratt had made on wet paint to dive inside. And I thought, okay, that must be the best, that must be the path that, the horses are getting good traction. But confidence game didn't come back to him.
No, and how about Keith DeZormo buying horses for, you know, bargain prices, you know, essentially just this horse for $25,000 and consistently delivering and being in a position to be on the Derby trail. Just phenomenal horsemanship on his part. What I was blown away about Christian Torres, watching him ride, because we've been covering Oaklawn as well. He's only been riding 3 years. I would have never, ever guessed it. I mean, he shows a poise and a confidence that guys that have only been riding 3 years rarely possess. And I think he is an absolute star in the making. I mean, he is just a really top-class rider.
There's actually been all kinds of interesting riding displays this season at Oklahoma. In fact, we talked about it with Jeff Taylor on Friday, and Francisco Arrieta, Jeff made the case about the bug, the 7-pound bug, and there's it's been interesting seeing, you know, and it's actually been a feast or famine. I mean, there's some veteran riders there that are struggling mightily, and have, yeah. You know, are getting garnished on a daily basis, that are doing offers, crazy offers. So anyway, just an aside.
The Nick was, I think, Juarez in there, and not an easy dude to start competing and get comfortable riding and fit in, because don't know the other riders' habits. You don't know how horsemen like their horses ridden. These
good
things
point.
You got to figure out. You know, and I think he's really settled in and made an excuse me, a nice impression there. There's an apprentice here in New York right now that everybody needs to really think about, and Jaime Torres. This kid, Angel Cordero, has him. Watch him hand ride, and you tell me that's an apprentice hand riding. I mean, he comes out of the jockey school in Puerto Rico, and obviously we've seen the product they turn out. But this kid... I haven't seen an apprentice in a very, very long time.
Interesting. Nice. You know, Rich, by the way, you mentioned Juarez. That clip from Saturday, Friday, that Cantamarsi put up?
What was that?
Well, Juarez and who was it? Juarez and wasn't Torres? I don't think, because Torres, I think, won the race. But they hit the wire together, and Juarez stood up and was screaming at him. and you said it would be on. You thought maybe somebody got in it, that he might have gotten inadvertently hit with the whip.
Well, I don't know about inadvertently, but there was some stick-shorting going on there.
I'm being gracious. Here it is. It was Arrieta and Juarez.
Yeah, I mean, I when I saw that clip, I was like, oh man, the room's going to get tore up. You can't have that. That's not acceptable behavior.
I saw that you commented right away, because a lot of people couldn't see what had happened. They were watching the winner and the runner up, who were, you know, separated by not a tremendous amount, maybe a length, but it was at the end of the clip, and it was the horses that were third and fourth that were engaged in whatever antics were going on.
Yeah, that was rough. I had one experience, or one that's notable, years ago, and I got hit during the race, and I stood up and I said something, and I had won the race, and the other jock should have just said, "I'm sorry." And he cursed at me and said, "Well, I'm trying to win. Well, hitting me isn't helping your horse go fast." So I reached over and I cracked him in the face, and he lost his right stirrup and was coming off. And I reached down, I grabbed him by the scruff of his neck, and I put him back in the middle. And then when we got back in the room, it was on. And a Kirk of Scales inadvertently did get punched, and I won't say by who, but he shouldn't have gotten away.
Well, the statute of limitations is over. I love it. Richie, this was fabulous. Thank you so much. It's unbelievable.
It was great catching up with you guys. Great being on with Rick, and I look forward to next week.
Rich Migliore, everybody, MIG 4450. Let's do this. We'll take a quick timeout. Mike Makowski's here. John White is here, and we're going to be back hour three at the races live at Santa Anita. Now this is the strange weather phenomenon where the sun comes up. It's morning, and it's colder now than it was an hour and a half ago.
I still don't see any sun.
There's
I don't
some
know,
light. I see blue sky. I see blue sky. That counts. That counts as sun.
Okay.
Back after this, the Santa Anita.